So I want you to imagine stepping into an art studio, right? You're there to create a masterpiece, but you deliberately strip away every single tool that you think an artist actually needs.
Right, just getting rid of all the basics.
Exactly. You toss out the brushes, you get rid of the palettes, you don't even set up an easel.
Which is pretty terrifying for a traditional painter. I mean, if you think about it.
Oh, totally. Instead, you're just holding a cup of liquid paint, you pour it directly onto a flat surface, and you literally just step back.
Yeah.
I mean, you are handing the steering wheel completely over to the raw, unfeeling physics of fluid dynamics. Colors are just like violently colliding, they're bleeding into one another,
Yeah,
sinking.
chaos. To anyone watching, it probably looks less like art and more like, a total disaster in the making.
100%.
It feels like an incredibly reckless way to work, especially when we consider our traditional view of the quote-unquote master artist.
Right, the guy with the tiny brush.
Exactly. We are so conditioned to revere the painter who exercises the supreme, like microscopic control, the genius making deliberate tiny strokes with a single hairbrush.
Yeah.
So relinquishing that physical control is a radical departure. You are completely surrendering to gravity, to momentum, and really just the chemical properties of the material itself.
Okay, well, let's unpack this because that surrender is the core of our deep dive today. We are exploring the mind of an artist who operates exactly this way, and we've got our hands on a really fascinating book called Trastio, Pintura Artistica by Jairo Duque. It
It's such a great source.
really is. But we aren't looking at his whole portfolio today. We are zooming in on a very specific set of his personal notes for a single piece of artwork, which is piece number 17. He titled it Wakari.
And, having access to these specific notes is what makes this exploration so rare for you listening.
Yeah, it's not the usual art critique stuff.
Not at all. Usually, when we stand in a gallery looking at complex abstract art, we're forced to play this speculative guessing game, right? We stare at a canvas and ask, well, what was the artist feeling here? What does this mean?
We're basically working backward from a finished static object.
Exactly. But with Duke's notes for Wakari, we are reading his real-time diary. I mean, we have an hour-by-hour account of his anxieties, the calculated risks he took, and this incredibly intense minute-by-minute battle between total chaos and absolute control.
Right, all while the acrylic was actively flowing,
Yes.
which is wild. So we aren't guessing his intentions. We are watching the choreography of the liquid through his eyes. And to really grasp the philosophy behind his process, we kind of have to start with the physical reality of the object itself.
Let's establish the anatomy of this storm, so to speak.
Yeah, the facts of it.
Yeah.
So the notes place the creation of this piece in Whittier, California. And this was in August of 2020. He's working with Liquitex acrylic paints. And a crucial detail he emphasizes, which I found mind-blowing, is that there was zero reference image.
Right, none.
He wasn't glancing at a photograph of a forest or, remembers a landscape. The entire visual language was born completely out of the pouring process.
So the process actually generates the image rather than the artist like imposing a pre-existing image onto the process.
Yeah, but honestly, the detail that completely stopped me in my tracks isn't the paint or the lack of a reference. It's the physical boundary he chose.
Oh, the size.
The size of this artwork is tiny. It is an 8 by 10 inch canvas.
Which is what, roughly 20 by 25 centimeters?
Exactly. When we think of chaotic abstract expressionism, paint being hurled or layered on super thick, we usually picture those massive wall-sized canvases taking up entire rooms in modern art museums.
You definitely don't picture something the size of a piece of standard printer paper.
No, it's like trying to compress the energy of a raging wild storm into a shoebox. I mean, every single square millimeter of activity is magnified to an extreme degree.
And that shoebox constraint, it forces a completely different mindset. If you're painting on a massive canvas, you have room for the paint to thin out, right? To
Yeah.
kind of dissipate its
Yeah,
energy.
you have breathing room.
Right. But when you compress that much raw material into an 8 by 10 space, Duke isn't really painting on a canvas anymore. He is attempting to choreograph how a highly volatile liquid behaves within a very strict, unforgiving border.
Because there's just so much of it.
Exactly. The primary challenge he notes is just the sheer abundance of material. When you introduce that much visual information into a tiny space, the immediate threat is that it will transform into just unbearable visual noise.
Okay, I want to dig into that concept of visual noise because, how does the brain actually process a compressed storm like that?
It's tough.
Right. If I'm looking at Wakari, how does Duke keep me or really anyone viewing it, from just getting totally overwhelmed and looking away.
Well, to understand that, we have to look at the visual structure he engineered, and he really built it almost like an architect. The layout of Wakari is dominated by this large, incredibly dense green mass anchored right in the center. And orbiting around that central green mass are these explosive, highly intense colors.
Yeah, I'm looking at the description here. We're talking about sharp violets, bright pinks, stark whites, and deep blacks.
All of them tangling and filtering through each other. If you looked at it closely, you might honestly think you were looking at a dense cross-section of a tropical jungle, or like maybe a living biological cell vibrating under a microscope.
That sounds beautiful, but also, I mean, exhausting. Because fundamentally, the human brain is a pattern-seeking machine, right?
Yeah.
We want to find order in chaos.
We crave order, which is exactly why the psychology of visual noise is so critical to this specific piece. When you are faced with extreme competing stimuli, like when there are a dozen loud colors fighting for your attention simultaneously in this tiny space,
yeah,
your brain struggles to organize it. It eventually just short circuits. It experiences what we can call visual white noise.
Wow, visual white noise.
Yeah, it is a genuine cognitive fatigue. You literally feel tired looking at something that chaotic because your brain is just working overtime trying to sort it out. So Duke had to find a way to bypass that cognitive fatigue.
Okay, but I have to admit some confusion here, mechanically speaking. If those violets and pinks are so intense and they are crammed into this 8x10 space, why don't they just burn your retinas?
Right.
I mean, how does the eye not just give up?
So Duke solves this by designing a closed circuit loop for your eye.
A closed circuit loop.
Yeah. Think about traditional Western art. The artist usually provides a resting point. Like, think of a classic Renaissance portrait.
Okay, sure.
The lines of the painting naturally guide your eye to the subject's face, usually their eyes, right? And your gaze just rests there. The composition is essentially telling you, hey, this is the most important part. You can park your vision right here.
Right. You find the anchor and you just hold on to it.
Exactly. But Wakari refuses to let you park. It forces continuous ocular movement, which sounds like it would be more tiring, but it's actually the opposite.
Wait, really? How does that work?
Well, that central green mass acts as a gravitational center. It keeps the composition from flying apart, but you can't rest on it.
Because of the texture.
Yes. Its texture is so rough, so dense and tangled, that it actively expels your gaze. The brain says, too much detail here, and it literally pushes your eyes outward toward those vibrant, energetic edges, the bright pinks and violets.
Okay, so you get pushed to the perimeter. But if you stay on the perimeter, aren't you just getting blasted by the bright colors? I mean, that's what we were just talking about.
You would be if you stayed there. But once your eye hits those intense, vibrating edges, the visual heat is too high.
Oh, I see.
It's almost too much for the brain to process, so the structural lines embedded in those edges push your eye right back into the darker, heavier center.
That is so cool.
It becomes an engine of perpetual visual motion. The reason your eye never gets tired looking at Wakari is because it is never trapped in one place. It is always traveling along this deliberate, rhythmic circuit.
It breathes, it has this biological pulse, you know, pushing you out, pulling you in.
Precisely.
But, okay, here's where it gets really fascinating for me, though. To understand how he actually creates those textures that physically push and pull the eye, we have to look past the art theory for a second and examine the hard science.
Yes, the physics.
Right. We have to talk about the literal microscopic physics happening on the canvas.
The artistic physics of fluids, as Duke details it. Because he is pouring, not brushing, he is relying entirely on the liquid to generate those textures.
And in the technique of acrylic pouring, for you listening who might not have tried it, you can't just squeeze paint out of a tube. It's too thick. It won't flow at all.
No, you'd just get a lump of paint.
Exactly. So artists mix the paint with diluents, which are these specialized liquid mediums that thin out the paint and change how it moves. But here's the secret mechanism, and I love this. While the diluent changes the viscosity, it doesn't change the physical weight of the pigment itself.
This is the crucial part.
Right. Every single color has a distinct mineral and chemical makeup.
Mm.
So, physically speaking, a cup of titanium white weighs significantly more than a cup of cadmium yellow.
And that difference in specific gravity is the engine of the entire process.
Yeah.
When Duke layers these thinned out liquid colors on top of each other, a microscopic thermodynamic battle begins right on the surface.
Yeah.
Gravity and physics just take over the composition.
So the paint is literally fighting itself.
Absolutely. The heavier pigments, like that titanium white we mentioned, they naturally want to sink to the bottom of the puddle, and the lighter pigments, which are trapped underneath, are frantically trying to force their way up to the surface.
It's like a wrestling match happening at a cellular level.
A very violent wrestling match. And yeah. As these pigments push and pull against each other vertically, they create incredible surface tension.
Right, the paint stretches.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Eventually, that thin membrane of paint stretches so far that it just has to break. It ruptures naturally, entirely on its own, forming these beautiful organic cells and webbing in the paint.
So the artist isn't painting those intricate shapes with a tiny brush.
Not at all. The thermodynamic struggle is tearing the paint open to reveal the colors underneath.
But wait, if physics is doing all the heavy lifting, right?
Yeah.
And the paint is just boiling and sinking and rupturing on its own, why doesn't it just turn into a giant, ugly mess?
Wow.
I mean, if I mix a bunch of wet, heavy paints together and just let them fight it out on a canvas, the colors usually just bleed together until I have something that looks like, I don't know, a duty puddle in a parking lot.
And that is a very real threat. Duke explicitly identifies that exact danger in his notes. He calls it the threat of chaotic homogeneity.
Chaotic homogeneity.
Yeah. If you leave a fluid system completely unchecked, the natural entropy will cause all those distinct, vibrant colors to overmix. They will merge into a boring, muddy brown sludge.
Right.
Uncontained chaos might sound exciting in theory, but visually, it's incredibly boring. It erases all identity and contrast.
Which brings up the most striking analogy from our research. To stop that muddy sludge from forming, Duke realizes he has to act less like a traditional painter and more like, well, a hydraulic engineer.
I love this analogy.
It makes so much sense. Think about a wild river roaring down a mountain. If that river floods a flat valley without any constraints, it just spreads out, destroys everything, and leaves a flat, boring layer of mud.
Yeah.
But an engineer doesn't try to stop the river with their bare hands. They build dikes. They build dams. They channel the brute force of the water to generate power without letting it destroy the landscape.
And that is the exact role Duke is playing. He is the engineer of the acrylic. He lets the liquid release its energy and generate those thermodynamic cells we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But right at the critical moment, right before the chaos overmixes and turns into that muddy homogeneity, he makes a physical structural intervention.
But how does he actually do that? If the whole thing is just a puddle of wet fluid, how do you build a dam out of liquid?
He introduces stark white lines across the composition. In his notes, he refers to these as causes vitales.
Which translates to vital channels, right?
Exactly, vital channels.
Like irrigation ditches for the paint. But again, mechanically, if the white line is also made of wet paint, why doesn't it just blend into the storm like everything else?
Because of when and how he applies them. He introduces these lines to disrupt the surface tension of the flowing mass. They act as structural pauses.
Oh, interesting.
By dragging these stark, heavy white lines through the chaotic areas, he creates artificial fractures. These lines redirect the brute force of the liquid. They manage the excess energy of the storm, essentially telling the paint, you can rage and flow, but only within this new boundary I've cut for you.
So it freezes the liquid right at its moment of maximum tension.
Yes.
He is basically negotiating with the physics. He lets the storm be wild, but he draws the boundary to keep it from destroying itself.
Yeah, he establishes a limit that keeps the material looking alive and brave, rather than just messy. It is a brilliant balance of relinquishing control to the fluid dynamics while maintaining just enough structural authority to prevent a total collapse.
Okay, so we understand the physics now. We've got the 8x10 physical boundary and the necessity of these vital channels. But I kind of want to play devil's advocate regarding the final result.
Okay, let's hear it.
We live in a highly demanding, fast-paced culture. When people buy art today, especially for their homes, they usually want something that looks nice in their living room.
Of course. They want something pretty.
Right. They want something harmonious and pleasant. So why would an artist actively choose to engineer a piece that Duke himself describes in his notes as having uncomfortable contrast and chromatic friction?
That's a great question.
By intentionally leaving those jarring pinks and rough greens, doesn't he risk totally alienating an audience that just wants something easy to look at?
Oh, it is a massive commercial risk. But Duke's philosophy actively rejects easy seduction. Yeah, he isn't interested in making something that perfectly matches the curtains in a modern living room. If art simply mimics the comfort of your couch, it completely loses its power to provoke thought. It ceases to be art and just becomes like wallpaper.
It fades into the background. It becomes invisible because it's just too easy to digest.
Precisely. The friction, that uncomfortable, high-contrast clash between the dense green and the vibrating pinks, is strictly necessary to give the work life.
I see.
Think about it this way. Eliminating friction in art is like preferring a perfectly smooth, flawless plastic loof mass-produced in a factory over a real, rough, slightly decaying leaf you picked up from the floor of an actual forest.
Oh, wow. That's a brilliant way to look at it. We crave the plastic leaf because it's safe.
Exactly. The plastic leaf might be quote-unquote perfect, but it is entirely dead.
Yeah.
The real leaf is asymmetrical. It's rough. It has flaws and signs of decay, but it is undeniably fiercely alive. Duke is choosing the real leaf.
He wants the decay and the growth happening at the exact same time on the canvas.
Oh.
And that really clarifies why he titled the piece Wakari. He notes that Wakari isn't a map of a real physical place you can go visit on a vacation.
Mm.
He calls it an emotional geography.
Mm-hmm.
It is meant to evoke the raw feeling of a fertile, humid, overwhelmingly dense jungle. You cannot convey the suffocating, vibrant reality of a wild jungle with neat, orderly pastel brushstrokes. You have to use the friction of the material itself.
It demands a level of commitment from the person looking at it, too. This piece actively resists the modern Instagram scroll culture.
Oh, for sure.
You know how it is? We are so used to glancing at an image on our phone for a fraction of a second, double tapping it, and moving on to the next piece of content.
Right, our eyes just slide right off it because there's nothing to catch on.
But the friction in Wakari catches you. It hooks your eye. It absolutely requires time and a certain disposition to appreciate. It is an act of resistance against superficial consumption. It gives you obvious points of beauty, like the organic cells, the vivid colors, to draw you in. But then it hits you with that roughness. That friction is what keeps the image bouncing around in your mind long after you've walked away from the canvas.
So bringing this all together, what does this deep dive mean for you listening right now?
We started with the radical, seemingly careless act of just spilling paint.
Right.
But underneath that spill, we uncovered a highly calculated process of emotional and physical engineering. We've seen how Duke battles chaos on a tiny 8x10 canvas. We've seen how he weaponizes the thermodynamics of fluid densities, using gravity to rip the paint open.
Mm.
And we've seen how he acts as a hydraulic engineer, building those causes, those vital channels to prevent his work from turning into a muddy, chaotic puddle.
And, you know, if we take Duke's framework out of the art studio and connect it to the bigger picture, the implications are incredibly relevant to the way we live today.
That's so. Think about the structure of our modern society.
Mm-hmm.
Our technology, our algorithms, our user interfaces, they are all specifically designed by engineers to eliminate discomfort. Everything is supposed to be smooth, seamless, and instantly gratifying.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
We want the frictionless life. We want the plastic leaf, the easiest commute, the app that orders our food with one tap.
Exactly. We are deeply conditioned to avoid chromatic friction, or really any kind of friction, in our daily lives. But Duke's notes raise a vital question for all of us. If we apply this frictionless logic to our own lives, our careers, or our personal projects, don't we risk the exact same fate as the unconstrained paint?
We risk the chaotic homogeneity.
Yes. Don't we risk becoming that flat, muddy puddle? If we never introduce any friction, if we never encounter a rough edge or a challenging contrast, we lose our vital energy.
Wow.
It is the friction that proves we are actually alive and not just functioning on autopilot.
Because if everything is too easy, everything just blends into a boring gray sludge. We lose the contrast that makes our experiences meaningful. So I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over today, building on Duke's concept of the vital channels. Where in your own life or in your own creative projects are you running away from friction?
That's a great question to ask.
Right. Where are you trying to force a perfectly harmonious, easy plastic aesthetic just to avoid the mess? Because maybe the goal isn't to constantly fight the storm or try to micromanage every single drop of chaos into something safe and comfortable.
Right.
Maybe it is time to grab your hard hat. Let the raw elements of your life collide. Let the thermodynamics do their work.
Embrace the mess.
Exactly. Instead of trying to stop the flow, start focusing on where you can build better vital channels for your own abundance. Don't fear the heavy, chaotic energy. Just learn exactly where to draw your white lines to channel it. We will catch you on the next deep dive.